But going down the list, Alicia, would you mind?
Sure. Hi, everyone. My name is Alicia Noel, and I do research and consulting regarding supply chain innovation in food and agriculture, specifically around traceability. And this started because of focus on food safety. Now I'm also co-editing a collection of research papers on blockchain uses for social and economic equity in blockchain and food supply, sorry, in agriculture and food supply chains. So if you're involved in agriculture or food and blockchain in any way, please let me know and I'm happy to share more information about the collection with you to get your research included.
Thanks, Alicia.
You're welcome.
Mark?
Yes, hi. Mark Liberati, policy specialist at United Nations Volunteers, a former UN volunteer myself, and involved in various forums on blockchain in the UN system, and then in our UNV Digital Transformation Working Group on AI, big data, and blockchain. And yeah, I'm looking for inspiration, action in using different frontier technologies that can be applied for mainstreaming, accelerating SDG policy. Thank you.
Thanks, Mark. Hey, Brent.
Hey, everybody. My name is Brent Zundel. I work for a company called Evernym. We've been dabbling in digital identity and blockchain for a few years now. And I'm here to talk to you guys about SSI.
We're really looking forward to it. And hey, Lindsay, are you also on the line? I don't know if we lost her, but hi. I see that there's also Chris.
Hey, good morning, everybody. Thank you. Yes, I'm new to the group and excited to join in and start to learn with a company called BixByte. We are looking at decentralized economies and work groups, co-ops, etc. We believe there's an opportunity in the decentralization and helping out workers right at the source of projects. And our particular area of focus to get started with is around artisanal miners, and certainly in line with supply chain integrity, but we think there's an economic value proposition as we move into decentralized economies, an economic value proposition rate for source workers, and that's kind of the use case we're focused on right now.
Awesome, welcome to the group. So
Thank
I
you.
think that's it right now. So what I'm going to quickly do is we just have a few administrative topics to walk through, and then we'll transition over to Brent's presentation for us. So thank you again for coming today. So just a couple different things that we want to just kind of throw out there. I think in the last call that we had, we talked a little bit about some certain blockchain technologies and ways that that might be used to combat COVID-19. You know, that's definitely an ongoing interest topic. You know, given that we're all kind of stranded at home because of the situation. So if that's something that somebody is interested in kind of continuing the discussion on, we do have some openings for presentation for, I think, the next meeting. So we can talk about that. Any takers, any interest before I move on? Okay. One of the other things, so I think a little while back, we had created a new member center. So one thing that we've been waiting for a little bit is just some feedback from the community members, especially, you know, Chris, since you're new, to kind of let us know if, you know, there are anything that we're, any gaps that we're missing, you know, that we need to fill, and if it does provide enough information kind of at the get-go to get you plugged in. And kind of any kind of, you know, user feedback, any ways like that. So and I would highly encourage, you know, any folks that are on this call to take a look at this and drop a comment in there or shoot us an email on the mailing list to let us know, you know, if there's any ways that we can improve this. And for Chris, I know that you're new. Just one thing to point out. So there's actually the Linux Foundation IDs, the LFIDs. So we actually have some instructions on that. If you're interested, I can shoot that over to you and I can drop that in the chat once Brent is presenting. And it'll be a great way to kind of get an ID account. And then you can contribute to all of these wiki pages as well as to different Jira and technical items. So that could be a great way to get started.
Yeah, I appreciate that. I thought I did register at one point, but you can shoot that my way. Thank you.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I just couldn't find you for some reason, but sounds good. The other thing that's really new, and I see that Lindsay's on, I'm hoping that she can speak at some point, but we are right now discussing developing a state of social impact blog post. Without giving too much away, and I'll have Lindsay do the driving if she's unable to, maybe on the next call. But we're looking for folks that are interested in different segments of social impact to kind of contribute to this blog post. So if this is something of interest, you know, drop us an email or, you know, shoot us an email or something like that. I think we'll, I'll have, you know, I think Lindsay will probably reach out to the mailing list and to folks on this call. If that is something that you guys are interested in contributing to. One of the other things that we're also working on is creating a social impact special interest group page, especially to consolidate different types of social impact resources. And Jim Couples, unfortunately, can't make it today, but he's the vice chair of this of social impact of the SIG. But he's leading that effort. And if you guys have any articles, anything that you guys see of interest, especially as it pertains to blockchain technology, best practices, stuff like that. You know, we'd love to kind of build out that repository so that folks joining this call and this group really can get easy access to this. So, you know, if this is something of interest, one way, you know, you could drop your name in this meeting notes or just shoot us an email, anything like that. Those would be great things to do. So just want to kind of flew through those a little bit, but is there any questions that anyone has or anything that you guys would like to share?
Yeah, hi. This is Mark. Again, I would just wanted to quickly note, and I'll put it in the chat, the UNDP is working right now on a hackathon. So it might be of interest to some people because it's through the Center for Technology Innovation and Sustainable Development, and it's the COVID-19 Detect and Protect Challenge. So those who are interested, I will just put the information in the link for those to peruse. Okay, over. Thank you.
Thanks, Mark. And I will add that to the meeting notes so that folks have it. And Mark, if you're interested, we could definitely also shoot that through the mailing list just to get more visibility.
Okay, yeah, I had thought about that. It's just I just replied to the, yeah, I'll figure that out. Yeah, that's fine. I'll do both. I'll put it in this chat and then I'll circulate that more broadly.
Sounds great. So without further ado, I don't know if folks know this, but April at Hyperledger is this month of April, is, I believe, the identity month. And so we're really fortunate to have Brent, who will be speaking with us. And I believe the topic is verifiable credentials, decentralized identifiers, and governance framework. So without further ado, I will transition it over to Brent. So Brent, do you want me to do the screen share or would you like for me to kind of give you host?
I'm happy to share my screen. The slides have some animations and I'd rather nobody else have to suffer through getting them wrong. Because I know
great.
I'm
wrong, with you. So I'll make you co-host and let me know if you can share screen.
I think I can only share my screen if whoever's sharing stops.
Let me do that.
All right. And see if this works. Okay. I'm assuming you all can see a great big slide with too many words on it.
And yes,
okay.
We can.
Okay. The standard, we have to do the standard Zoom things. Can you see my screen? Can you hear me okay? Okay. I'm going to talk to you guys about three big ideas that together kind of make the building blocks of SSI. And SSI is the shorthand for self-sovereign identity. And we say SSI rather than self-sovereign identity because when people hear self-sovereign identity for the first time, they often think about people who live in the woods and don't want to get a driver's license and never pay their taxes. And that's not what this is about. This is about allowing people to own and control their own identifiers and personal information. We strongly believe that people holding keys at the edge and data at the edge is a much more sustainable way for people to identify themselves and for this whole world to move forward. There we go. This is me. I have a few hats. I am a senior crypto engineer at Evernym. Mostly that means I read too many papers and look at too much code. About part-time, I'm also the co-chair of the DID working group at the W3C. We're working on a standard for decentralized identifiers. I help maintain the Hyperledger Ursa project, and I contribute regularly to Aries and Indie as well. Evernym, the company that I work for, we are a commercial vendor of SSI software and solutions. Three or more years ago, we open sourced all of the stuff that we built so far and gave it to the Sovereign Foundation. Sovereign Foundation is a nonprofit global public utility. So it's kind of like a global gas company or a global electric company, but it's a utility for anybody to use for the purpose of self-sovereign identity. And we'll go into a little bit more what that means. The Sovereign Foundation turned around and open sourced that code even more by creating the Indie project at Hyperledger, which spun out the Ursa project for cryptographic libraries and the Aries project for agents and wallets. And so we at Evernym, we like to say we follow the open source model. Yeah, that joke wasn't funny when the CEO told it either, but you know, here's the greenhouse we know and love. Hyperledger Indie is a blockchain project that allows for people to anchor decentralized identifier public keys, as well as anchoring schemas and public keys for the issuance of verifiable credentials. Oh, and just an aside, if anybody has any questions at all while I'm presenting, please don't feel like you need to wait for me to stop or interruptions don't bother me. So if as I'm going, you're like, I have no idea what you're talking about, or I want to know more about that, please let me know. Ursa is the shared cryptographic library at Hyperledger. It handles all of the fancy signatures and message encryption and all of those things that we use. And Aries is built for peer-to-peer interactions. It's a different model of looking at things than the traditional client-server architecture. It's more of a client-to-client architecture, or rather, the way I like to think of it, it attempts to bring the web back in line with some of the original vision of the web. You know, when Tim Berners-Lee created the World Wide Web, his idea was everybody can run their own server, and all of these servers will be able to talk to each other. And as we know, oh, I don't know, perhaps you guys all do, but I don't have a server, and so I'm not a node on the web. What Aries allows is for people to, I don't know, play a bigger role and have a little bit more control over their information. All right, so what is this all about? We have this new identity model. How does it work? Well, in a nutshell, verifiable credentials are like a digital wallet, and not just a digital wallet for money, but a digital wallet for anything else you might have in your wallet. inside your wallet. You could have your member ID for your credit union. You could have some lab results from your doctor. You could have verification from your bank that, yes, I got this approval for my auto loan. There are all of these credentials that in the real world, we carry them around all the time. We use them all the time. So far, digital equivalents have been hard to use and difficult to use in the same way. If I'm issued a driver's license, I can take that driver's license, I can use it as a form of personal identification, and I can use it to show the officer that, yes, I'm licensed to drive, even though I was driving too fast just now. When the officer looks at my license, the officer doesn't have to call into the DMV and make sure that the license was issued properly and all of this. They can tell by looking at the credential. Now, he's going to look up to make sure all of my other speeding tickets have been paid, but that's a different system. That's a different thing altogether. So in a nutshell, that's what SSI is and attempts to be. So we talk about this triangle. We have an issuer that signs credentials, gives these attestations to a holder, and the holder has their data. The holder has keys that can establish their identity and their control over the identifiers that they use, and they can create proofs based on these credentials and present them to a verifier. The verifier doesn't talk to the issuer, doesn't need to. All of the communication between issuer and verifier happens by way of what we are calling a verifiable data registry. So the issuer puts something on this registry, the verifier can read it, know that it came from the issuer, and can use that to verify the proofs that have been presented to it by the holder. So these are the three roles that we talk about with SSI and credentials. So verifiable credentials, here we go. Here's our trust triangle. So the blockchain sits there at the bottom. Now in the uses that I am involved with, that blockchain is Indy. And specifically it's Sovereign. The Sovereign network is an instantiation of Hyperledger Indy. So Indy is the code. Sovereign is the real world, functional production level instantiation of it. Issuers give verifiable credentials to holders. Holders store them in their wallets. Holders make proofs to verifiers. The issuer writes the keys to the blockchain, signs the credential. The verifier reads the public keys from the blockchain and verifies the credential. The nice thing is that this dotted line between the verifier and the issuer rather than a solid line. The issuer is not going to be aware of every time the holder uses the proofs based on their credentials. Just like the government isn't informed every time I use my driver's license as a form of identification. This distancing between the issuer and the verifier allows for a little bit more freedom, a little bit less privacy stripping. All the verifier needs to be able to do is trust who the issuer is. So for example, we have a doctor's passport that we're working with. The NHS in the UK is the issuer. The NHS writes their DID to the Sovereign Ledger. They issue a doctor's passport to one of their doctors. The first passports that are being issued are to doctors who will be going from hospital to hospital in the NHS system in order to better treat the COVID-19 patients that they have. The NHS signs the passport, the doctor receives it, holds it in their wallet, and then when they go to onboard at any hospital in the system, they present it to the verifier, who reads the keys from the ledger and verifies that they are a doctor, that they're authorized to be a doctor and to work there. The cool thing about this technology is it's taken Historically, when a doctor moves to a new hospital, in order to go through all of the paperwork and onboard them, it's at least a full day of work. With the credentials in digital form and the ease of verification, we've taken that full day and brought it down to about 3 minutes, which I think is pretty darn cool. So that's credentials. We also have peer-to-peer connections. Peer-to-peer connections are enabled by these decentralized identifiers. So the issuer has a public DID. They put it on the blockchain. Anybody can look at it. Anybody can see the keys that are related to it. Anybody can verify messages that are signed by that identifier's keys. The holder and the issuer, they create pairwise DIDs. The holder doesn't have to anchor an identifier to a ledger. The holder just has an identifier that the issuer knows. So the issuer knows who the holder is. The holder knows who the issuer is, and because of the keys associated with those DIDs, they can construct a secure channel of communication. Not just secure, but secure with some assurance behind it. The issuer not only knows that nobody else can read these messages, they know that only the holder can get them. The holder has a similar pairwise relationship with the verifier. Now, when the verifier talks to the holder, they see this identifier. When the issuer talks to the holder, they see a completely different identifier. So even if the verifier and the issuer were to collaborate and get together, they wouldn't be able to necessarily say that they were talking to the same person as the holder. So that's how DIDs fit into it. Governance frameworks are a very important part. So far we've been talking about technology, and technology is great. As a cryptographer, I love math, and I love the way that math can be used in clever ways to solve real problems. But I also do standards work, and as a standards engineer, I recognize that math can only take us so far. We need some form of governance, and the reason that we need governance is to answer the question, how can a verifier know who an issuer is? How can a verifier know what issuers to trust? How can a holder know what issuers can actually give them credentials that are worth anything? That's where governance frameworks come in. So the governance framework adds a second trust triangle. You see, the original issuer can also be a holder. So the governance authority, someone recognized by everybody as an authority, think if you're thinking technology like the web, this would be like a certificate authority. Everybody recognizes who these people are. This also could be the government driver's license division. It could be the small business office of the government who's authorizing small businesses to do things. The governance authority issues a credential. That credential goes to the issuer. Say the governance authority is MasterCard and the issuer is a bank. MasterCard authorizes the bank to issue credit cards that have the MasterCard logo on them and will be processed by MasterCard. The holder is the cardholder. The bank issues a credit card, a verifiable credential that has the unique string in it that allows the cardholder to make payments using the MasterCard network. The verifier is a merchant. Now the verifier has a proof from the bank that they are a MasterCard issuer and trust in the governance authority of MasterCard. The doctor's passport example is another one where we have this governance framework triangle. In this instance, the governance authority is the NHS. And then we have a set of authorized providers. There are only certain hospitals that are allowed to issue credentials. All of those credentials are accompanied by a proof that the issuer has authority from the NHS. They issue the passports to the doctor, who presents them to the different hospitals. So the governance frameworks and the digital credentials are two sides of the same coin. They allow for all of the different layers to work together to provide an actual solution for self-sovereign identity. And that's the end of the bulk of my presentation. Happy to take questions. I've also got, if you guys are interested, I have some slides about how credentials are being used in the wake of COVID-19. If you guys would be interested in that, I can keep talking at you, or we can go however you want to go.
Yeah. Can we just ask a question now, or?
Yeah, go for it. Ask questions, or I can. I have a few more slides if you guys want them.
I can wait. It's just.
Let's see. We don't care about trust over IP. Oh, maybe you guys care about trust over IP. I'm imagining you don't care about trust over IP. So let's go to.
Is that about intellectual property law?
It's called the Trust Over IP Stack. It's not intellectual property. It's internet protocol.
Oh, I see.
So yeah, let's see. Can I start from here? That's the question. I don't even know. Oh, anyway, so I'll zoom through the Trust Over IP stuff quick because it's probably not something you guys are interested in. Technical layers for the different protocols, and each of them has a governance component. There's, you know, the public utility DIDCOM for connections, data exchange for credentials, and then applications built on top of that is the idea. We actually have a Trust Over IP Foundation at the Linux Foundation that's building up the different internet scale layers for this. And if you want to get involved, reach out and I will tell you more about that. This is the cool part. So in the wake of COVID-19, people started asking, okay, when we get through this, we're going to need to be able to prove. So say I've been tested and I had it and I have the antibodies and I can prove that I had the antibodies. What good does that do me? How do I present that? How can we do this in a privacy preserving way? So Evernym started organizing people and inviting people to take part in what is called the COVID Credentials Initiative. We are using digital certificates based on the verifiable credentials standard from the W3C that allows people to prove they've recovered or have been tested for antibodies or have received a vaccination. More than 60 organizations are participating in uniting. Basically, this is a way for them to unite on a common form for these credentials to take. This is the establishment, essentially, of a governance framework around COVID-19 credentials. And this is, there are lots and lots of different companies involved here. And the key is that they can do this without the compromise of privacy. I think we've all, I don't know, I've been heavily involved in a lot of debate around contact tracing applications, and there are right ways to do that and wrong ways to do that. This is something different, but similarly, there's a right way to do credentials around COVID-19 and a wrong way. The right way is with self-sovereign identity in place so that people have control over their data, control over when they share it, and no need for the issuers to be tracking everywhere those credentials are used. The different credentials that are under development right now are some mobility credentials for healthcare workers. That was the doctor's passport that we talked about earlier, as well as proof of the personal protective equipment. When a doctor goes to a new hospital, it'll take a couple of hours for them to be fitted with and be approved to use the protective equipment that they're issued. With the credentials, they just have to show that they've already gone through that, along with a credential that says what size of everything ought to be for them to fit it, and they can just be issued their equipment and go on their way. All of these other proofs that can be provided, proofs that they've had immunity by the vaccine or by exposure, proof that they are a trusted issuer of these credentials. If you'd like to know more, there's a link. Evernym.com, COVID-19. So this digital passport that we talked about, the NHS is actively doing this right now. We are in development with them, and by the end of this month, they will be live in several hospitals, with doctors actively moving between hospitals much more rapidly. And that is the end of all of the slides that I thought I might show you today.
It's a great presentation, Brent. I had a couple questions for you. Have you had any discussion or thoughts on mobility of people between across borders once it's kind of implemented and in place? So maybe I'll just start with that first one.
Yes, we have talked about that and thought about that. For example, what is it? Emirates Airlines has already started requiring people who want to fly on their airline to prove that they've either had it or, you know, recovered from it, that they have the antibodies. They haven't established any sort of way to do that in a privacy preserving manner. We're talking with SICPA, which is an organization that handles, it basically handles all of the airport stuff for airlines, all of the gating requirements and all of the transfer in and out of things. That combined with several governments that are involved, would certainly make something like, a passport for travel, I've already had COVID kind of passport for travel, a very real thing. Yes.
And just probably go back up to the first half of your presentation, which was, I thought was great. I'd just be curious on what is the feedback on some of the governance, like the feedback from use cases of people actually implementing around items around the governance and people actually putting their data on and feeling comfortable with it. I guess I'm trying to, maybe the question is around what is the adaptability of people using it that may have been reluctant. I get early adopters are going to use it quick, but how are you managing, or what are the types of use cases or feedback you're getting from people that may be reluctant to want to engage on the technology?
There are two sides of reluctance that we've run into, two general classes of it. The first general class of reluctance is people who don't understand how the technology works. So we try to educate and we try to be very, very clear. The whole goal of self-sovereign identity is to put control in the hands of actual people, to allow them to hold their private keys and all of the data that they need. Without that data, so none of people's personal data is ever put on a blockchain anywhere. It's not even hashed. The mechanisms for verification don't require that. The only thing that's on the blockchain is public data of issuers and information about the shape of the credentials, the shape of the data. No issuance of data happens on the chain. So once people kind of wrap their brains around that part of it, that generally addresses that type of reluctance. The other type of reluctance is once people grasp the technology a little bit better, they have that, oh crap moment. You mean I'm actually going to be responsible for holding private keys? There are a lot of people in the world who have jumped into Bitcoin and Ethereum and kind of either gone deeply into or played around with this digital currencies. Kind of a nerve-wracking experience is holding your wallet, holding your private keys, using them, and I'm trying to transfer what ultimately is real money between different people. What if it doesn't work? What if it falls through the cracks? There's not, with the Bitcoin and the cryptocurrency space, there isn't a lot of governance around that. There's not a lot of, say, if I go to the bank and I transfer something, or if I have a credit card and my number gets stolen and a whole bunch of transactions go through that I didn't actually authorize, there are governance mechanisms in place to address those. With SSI, it's still very new. And so systems are being built and the governance frameworks alongside them. When people first hear the technology, they think, oh, awesome. And they build this thing and they haven't done the governance. And so the second level of reluctance is, wait, now people are actually responsible for things and maybe they don't want to be. And so solutions are still being developed to address that. I hope that answers your question.
It does. And if I could think about to your doctor use, the doctors and the passport concept, if I could add one more layer to it. So, I mean, I'm not a healthcare expert, but I'm envisioning, medical or doctor associations that have a governance model to say is, an existing governance model that says, we consider you a certified doctor upon all these criteria being met, probably paying your dues and being an active member in good standing and all those types of things are part of the doctors association. I'm using a global blanket for them. They probably all have some version of this. So I'd be curious if you've engaged with those types of groups and said, can we take your existing governance that you use for your members in your associations and can we layer that on to the passport concept? And then as an extension of that, have you gotten into the things of tracking reputations of doctors on there and saying, you have your credentials on there, but I've also I've managed 100 COVID cases and here's my outcomes. Have you gotten into the discussions of those type of reputational management type pieces?
So to tackle the first part, your first question was around, like the American Medical Association or the different doctors boards that are out there, certification systems. They haven't reached out to us just yet. The tack that Evernim is taking, so with the NHS, that's kind of like all of the UK. In America, hospitals and medical care is a little bit different. So we do have several hospital systems that are actively engaged in developing and working on these things. And my expectation is that once enough of those are on board, the doctor's credential is this doctor is authorized to be a trauma surgeon at any of our hospitals. And so the governance framework in place there is the hospital system. Usually it's a regional system of hospitals. My expectation is that once enough of those are in place, then the broader governance frameworks that issue the credentials that the hospitals have been relying on will also get involved. So that's how I'm anticipating it happening, but who knows what's going to happen next. Your second question, help me to remember what your second question was.
Just on reputational management, on the concept of reputational management, I'm not worried about getting too weedy, but has that come up yet of tracking doctors' reputations and stuff?
We have talked a lot about reputation. And the one thing that we are sure of and absolutely positive about is that reputation is really, really, really hard to get right and pretty easy to get wrong. So at this stage, it's not a solution or a set of capabilities that we're actively introducing. My expectation is that in time, this will certainly be a thing. At an early phase, the way I imagine it beginning is, it's kind of like the Amazon verified purchaser. If I've received a product, Amazon knows I've received a product. So if I log on and make comments about that product, I get the little tag that says this person actually bought it. It's that mini certification sort of thing. If I go to a doctor and I get the bill from a doctor in a credential form, I can prove that I went to that doctor. And with that proof, maybe my comments and my rating will have a little bit more weight. And so that's how I imagine the reputation stuff beginning. There's a lot more, math that can be involved in an automation and, we can throw AI at it and all of that. But I think the beginning's gonna start, it's gonna look a lot like what we have now, just, with the check marks that mean something.
Great. Thank you. I really appreciate the presentation and the feedback. Thanks very much.
Sure. Does anybody else have questions?
Yeah. If I can just jump in. I had a few questions, so I'll go through them, but I've written them down in case you... So on the one, you talked about public utility and how sovereign was a global public utility. Although, I was just thinking about the legal form, because generally public utilities do have general a legal form with democratic representational input and a mandate for making decisions based on the public interest. So thinking about how that then is validated, that those, or even reflected on looking back, that those decisions were made based on the public interest. I wanted to ask about the centralization of the issuer and verifier, because a big benefit of blockchain obviously is a decentralized ability that it offers. However, if you're still going through the NHS or any of these other issuers, the DMV, that still then goes through these centralized systems and centralized databases. So what is lost there, and what are the thoughts in decentralizing that further? I was thinking around the governance models, and particularly with the Libra and looking at consortiums of different stakeholders to optimize that governance model, and what interesting innovations have come around that. Also on the actual blockchain where you're writing and reading and pooling that the data that will then, and you said non-personal identifying data for both the issuer and the verifier, who's running the nodes? I mean, who's maintaining that data integrity? Are they the similar people? I was curious on the business model for SSI in the private sector, and then on the comment on reputational credentials, I was thinking, and you'd mentioned AI or maybe like ethical augmented intelligence systems, like making that outcome based, so it's not just did the patient enjoy the doctor or did the other doctors think it was great, but really making that data driven and evidence based against the outcomes, the health outcomes that are established, and making those like KPIs to drive that those decisions, you know, towards the best outcomes for the patient. So those are my questions. Thank you. Over.
Okay, so give me the first one again, and I'm going to ask for one at a time.
Oh yeah, the first one was more just on the public utility part. So like, I mean, what legal form, if any, does that actually have?
Okay, so
on looking for the public and having a mandate for public, what's in the public interest? How is that then done? And what technology supports that in validating and ensuring that it is done, those decisions are made in the interest of the public?
Right, so there are several different types or blockchain solutions out there. There's the what's thought of as a fully decentralized, you know, anybody can run a node. We call them, permissioned networks. They're public permissioned or public permissionless systems. You know, Bitcoin and Ethereum, anybody can spin up a node, anybody can take part in the consensus algorithm, anybody can write to them and read from them. Then there's the fully private, like Fabric is a private permissioned model that if you want to run a node, you have to be in the consortium. If you want to write something to the ledger, you have to be in the consortium. If you want to read from the ledger, you have to be in the consortium. It's very, it's a decentralized mapping of what essentially becomes a central system. It allows for the network to match the governance of those involved. Indy splits the difference. So Indy is a public network. Anybody can read from it. Anybody can write to it. But it's a permissioned network in that only those who have signed agreements and I'm talking specifically about the sovereign instantiation of Indy. Only those who have interacted with the Sovereign Foundation will become stewards. They've signed legal agreements that they're going to act, you know, in a trustful manner, and they establish their keys, and so they become part of, they run one of the nodes on the network. On the technology side, the consensus algorithm is actually a little bit more more difficult to take advantage of. So with fully decentralized systems, usually you're looking at what they call a 50% attack. If somebody can control more than 50% of the nodes in a network, then they can completely take over the network. With Indy, it's a Byzantine fault tolerant consensus algorithm. So in order to take over the network, you'd actually have to compromise 2/3 of the nodes. And because those nodes are permissioned and public, everybody knows who they are. They know who the stewards are. And there is reputation involved in stewards that act badly. So if a steward tried to do nasty things, everybody would know exactly who they are. So we've found kind of a sweet spot in the middle. Did I answer that?
Yes, that was very comprehensive. It was more on the, but still, if you're dealing with the, I understand. So, I mean, if the NHS wants to, or even all the hospitals in the NHS become in, they're in a public permission blockchain, it loses a bit of, I mean, the permission loses a bit of the decentralization benefit. That was my point. And just thinking about how you could make that verifier, I mean, the issue and verifier in the fully decentralized model work while maintaining the trust and integrity of the data, because I do understand currently we have very centralized and they're moving to like more quasi-decentralized models while trying to sometimes maintain their central power. And the benefit of that full decentralization then is a bit diluted. So just thinking about how that could be further decentralized.
So I think that we achieve quite a bit of the decentralized benefits, because anybody can write an ID to the ledger, and anybody can, heck, I could write a DID to the ledger and start issuing COVID-19 passports to doctors. I could do that. I don't have a governance framework saying that my passports mean anything. So the verifiers are the other end are going to go, okay, well, we don't know who this guy is. So on one hand, it's fully decentralized. Anybody can issue whatever they want to whomever they want. The recognition is, though, in the real world, if I issued you a driver's license, the cop isn't going to recognize it as a valid driver's license. And that's less an aspect of decentralization and more just an aspect of the recognition that there, not everyone has the same authority to do everything. You know, if I get pulled over, I would expect the police officer to prove to me that they're a police officer. You know, I don't have to take their word for it. So I think that we hit a good balance in that respect. I think the governance frameworks are a vital component of that.
Yeah, right. I mean, that was a bit, I mean, my again, in the governance model, so looking at more still decentralizing, because I guess the state is still the issuer of these credentials for doctor's passport. Sometimes that's actually been a private guild. I mean, you have the state that's giving you the licenses, the identification, the police credentials, the badge. And so that then is just thinking about the models that you have to decentralize that governance, that you could have other stakeholders that are still trusted parties or they're accredited by each other as trusted parties, so that you can then decentralize that. So you're not dealing with just one state issuer of IDs as we currently have. Or one right.
Right. Yeah. So the problems with decentralization that are often brought up when talking about a public permission model are actually problems with, you know, the decentralization of the world as it is now. It's not really the technology prohibiting a more decentralized way of doing it. It's the world isn't set up like that just yet. But once it is, I think the technology will be able to make that just as relevant and valid. So what were your other questions?
The one just to follow up was just thinking around the, when we just said the badge and, I was just thinking about the question of reputational credentials and looking at you said there was a lot of flaws with reputational credentials in the way they're currently done. You gave the Amazon model, which seems to be quite popular, like the 5 stars or the customer rates you. But I was thinking more about looking at the outcome, having an outcome base where you're doing an evidence-based assessment. If a doctor makes a certain prescribed course of action, and then you can test that if that was then against, you know, the standard, and then drive that so that there's a consensus on if that was ultimately the best recommended course of action that can be tested by evidence, and sort of moving into away from sort of reputation is then linked to the stated outcomes that the system is trying to promote as a policy.
So I would say that the best reputation systems are those that are driven by the best data. The data, basically, if you know where the data came from and you know it hasn't been messed with, then you're going to be able to build a reputation system that is going to be, you know, more accurate. So the components that SSI provides there are the verifiable credentials. Verifiable credential is a set of claims that you know the source they came from, and you know that they haven't been tampered with. And so SSI provides the data and can provide really good data. An example that we give, you know, people are like, how is this SSI thing going to work in a world where Google tracks everyone and gets a whole bunch of information and then, you know, finds out all these things and then can sell advertisements? And we said, okay, what would be more valuable to a car dealership? A bunch of data that's been gleaned from a whole bunch of sources for people who, you know, were searching for things in such a way that they might be interested in buying a new car, or data from the users themselves that is in a certified form that says, not only have I am I looking for a car, that's my claim, but here's a credential from my bank that shows I'm approved for a loan. You know, so the quality of the data is going to, I think, make a big difference in the way the world shapes itself around SSI, incorporating both the big data approach that we have now. I don't think we're going to have the same big data approach in the future. I think we're going to have a better data approach. So companies are still going to want to find out things. The sources for that data are going to be different, and the quality of that data is going to be much, much higher. So they're going to be able to accomplish even more, just in a different way, and in a way that is, you know, more privacy preserving and I, in my opinion, much better for people.
Thanks, Brent. There's just one more question that was raised in the group chat from Lindsay. She said, hi, Brent, my sound isn't cooperating, so bear with me, but could you please speak to how Evernote's solution compares to other DID approaches in the area of cross-chain interoperability, maturity, whether it's ready for enterprise use, and ease of adoption and implementation for interested developers?
Okay, so Evernym, so we use Sovereign as a network right now. If Sovereign were to go away, Evernym wouldn't. Evernym would, you know, shift their products and solutions to other indie ledgers and to whatever else is out there to support as a backbone. The Sovereign, you know, the Sovereign ledger is a vital component, but it's only one component. Our solutions are pretty mature. We've been in the SSI space pretty much since there was an SSI space. We have actual companies doing actual things with actual customers. You know, these are real world, real production cases that are being used. Apart from that, the technologies that we use are being used in production elsewhere. The government of British Columbia uses the Sovereign Ledger to issue business licenses today to actual businesses. So there's more and more of this going on as far as maturity. Interoperability is truly a goal for anyone who truly believes in self-sovereign identity. One of Evernym's founding principles is that if you can't fire us, then we're not truly self-sovereign or allowing self-sovereign identity. We want to be able to be interoperable with everyone so that someone who's holding their data can take that data and go play somewhere else. We don't want the notion of vendor lock-in is anathema to our company, which I love, and I, you know, is different from other companies that I've been at. So while interoperability truly is a goal, most of it is coming through, like Aries is a good example of, you know, standards around interoperability. So if I have an Evernote agent and someone else has a StreetCred agent, then those agents can actually talk to each other. If I have a credential issued, now verifiable credentials is a web standard, but it's a generation one data model web standard. So even if two companies are fully compliant with the standard, they're still going to have to do a lot more work in order to truly be interoperable. The good news is that work is happening. So right now, no, there's not a lot of interoperability. There is active movement toward it and an intention to be fully interoperable. But ease of adoption, I'd say that in my biased opinion, Evernim's products are the most easily adoptable because we've got the chops. We have internal interfaces and implementations that allow people with solutions they want to build, we give them the ability to build those solutions very, very quickly. I'm talking, you know, in terms of days and weeks rather than months. So feel free to reach out if you guys are interested in pursuing that. That's my
Thank you so much, Brent. We're a little bit out of time, but so Brent, if it's okay with you, I will surface out your email in case folks have any questions that they can kind of follow up with you.
Of course.
Awesome. Sounds great. Thank you everyone so much for your time. And thanks again, Brent. And we'll talk soon.
Yeah, it was a pleasure.